Maddox, actually, I think the chances for the House impeaching are probably, at this point, fairly strong, fairly good, because the House moves more impetuously than the Senate does anyhow. It's too early to tell, really. They're all going to be terribly distressed, terribly upset, and awfully impressed with the gravity of the decision they face. But I am inclined to agree with Senator Hatfield that the floodwaters have started. Of course, impeachment is only the equivalent of an indictment when it gets over to the Senate for trial. That's an entirely different matter. I doubt very much whether the president would be convicted. But even Senator Dole, with whom I talked this evening just a few moments ago, who used to be Republican National Chairman, he just got back from Kansas, and he said, well, impeachment, if Congress is so inclined, is its only recourse for punishment, or words to that effect. So I think it is a very real possibility. Of course, by the time all the members of Congress get back from the Senate's on a two-week recess and the House is sort of running on one cylinder, by the time they all get back and sit down and think the thing over, they may have had a chance to cool off a little bit. But the temper as of tonight is not one that I would consider reassuring if I were sitting in Mr. Nixon's chair at the moment.
Bob, let me try a couple of propositions with you. One is that the House has not been able to override presidential vetoes. So therefore, people are asking, if they can't get enough votes to override a veto, can they get enough votes to move toward impeachment?
Well, it seems to me the answer to that is there's a big difference between a veto and between the president, in effect, setting a policy in which he says a normal course of justice is just fine, except when it gets too close to me, and then I tell the attorney general he can't enforce the law, which is the colloquial attitude a good many members of Congress have towards this situation in their preliminary judgment now. There's a huge difference between vetoing a bill involving 8 Public Health Service hospitals and trying to override that veto, and the president sort of setting himself up. I'm speaking in terms of the congressional view of it, the view the congressman might take, of setting himself up sort of apart from everything else. This is, as you said at the beginning, this is something we've never had before in this country, and I think I don't think it really can be compared with a veto. This is new.
Bob, let me try another question for you with your knowledge of the House. All members of the House have to run for re-election next year. In the wake of Watergate, what kinds of pressures will be on them if the country begins to perceive the problem as you have stated it, that the president is trying to say the law is all right, but not when it applies to me?
Well, we'll simply have to wait and see. If the country puts the problem in those terms, I think the pressures are going to be enormous, and I think action is going to be very swift. But the country usually doesn't respond quite that abruptly, and in this instance, I think that members of Congress themselves will, as I said before, drag their feet because it's such a terribly important and distressing decision to have to make.
Bob?
John Chancellor, I'd like to ask Senator Mathias a question. We tend to forget, was it just last week that the vice president resigned and received a prison sentence? We don't have a vice president. Now, what's this going to do to Gerald Ford's confirmation hearings in the Senate? Going to make it more difficult? Will the Senate really confirm Mr. Ford now until this business gets settled with President Nixon?
I think the honest, candid answer to that is that Jerry Ford's going to be an innocent victim, at least temporarily, of this process. I can't see either House accelerating its action on the confirmation of a vice president because of these events. I think the tendency is going to be to slow down. There was already a philosophy on the Hill that as long as the tape question was up in the air, it raised certain constitutional uncertainties, and that perhaps we shouldn't have a new Nixon nominated vice president until that was over anyway. And this will, I think, deepen that particular feeling.
Can I try something much more exotic on you? And that is this. The Senate committee, as you know, failed in its bid for the tapes because there is no precise statute, as it turns out, which gives the Senate committee jurisdiction to go into court and sue civilly to obtain such materials. Do you think, in light of this, anyone would be tempted to rush such a statute through to give the Senate committee jurisdiction just to really find out now what's on those tapes? Such a suit would not be subject at all to presidential interference, at least in its prosecution.
Of course, the statute would be subject to veto. Any bill
and that would be subject to override,
which would have to be overridden. So that's a cumbersome process. I think that when you think about what can be done in this situation, you turn to tools that are at hand. The court could, of course, of its own motion, appoint a prosecutor. In these unusual circumstances, I believe that the Congress would have to back up that decision with sufficient funding, because this is, of course, a massive job, and so I believe there would have to be coordination between the Congress and the court, even for a court-appointed prosecutor. But I think that's a more easily available alternative.
In the meantime, who's going to run the country? What I'm asking is, how long can we keep this up?
Well, we've been at it too long already, as you know. It's been a terrible and a tragic time.
Gentlemen, I think it might be valuable at this point in the evening to give the president's position on this. There is a presidential position. He is going to get immense criticism for that position, but as summarized by sources in the White House tonight, here's what they're saying. They're saying that the president, having offered a compromise for the issue of the 9 disputed tapes, actually 10 if you add the tapes the committee wants, the 10 disputed tapes, that the president, having offered a compromise, had no choice in what he did tonight. He is the head of the executive branch. He could not tolerate among men nominated by him to high positions in the Department of Justice that they would not obey his orders. So that sometimes, they say, the president has to take the heat. The president took it tonight. The president understands, it is said, former Attorney General Richardson's position, because he did say things, as we've heard Senator Mathias say here tonight in his confirmation hearings, that limited his action in terms of the special Watergate prosecutor. In terms of Cox, the White House felt that he was in open defiance as a member of the executive branch, that Archibald Cox, thereby an employee of the president, the White House says, others place it differently, was in defiance of his superiors, and so he had to go. In terms of William Ruckelshaus, that was more difficult, but he did refuse a presidential order and therefore automatically had to be fired. The White House says that the compromise the president offered on Friday night, very late in that day, delayed incidentally because they were talking with Senators Ervin and Baker of the Watergate Committee to get their assent to the compromise, and they got that assent, that the compromise was the best thing the president could do. The president said that he wanted to avoid a grave constitutional dispute that would last a long time. The president said he thought he would win in the Supreme Court. That is his belief, not the belief of many others who observed this case, but he didn't want to drag it out, and so he's done this. And that is about the White House position now. They realize in the White House that they are in the midst of an extremely difficult situation. They realize they're going to get a lot of criticism and that they have set in motion events that no one really can predict the outcome. I wonder if Tom Brokaw, who is at the White House at this moment on the lawn, has anything to add to that.
Just one thing, John. They're also making clear that they felt they had to act in the manner in which they did because the president also is giving a good deal of attention to those events going on in the Middle East. Secretary of State Kissinger, of course, is in Russia at this time. The war continues, and the president wanted to get back to trying to settle that war as well. That's another official White House position that I just wanted to add to your litany as to why the president acted in the manner that he did tonight.
Thank you, Tom. We'll be back with more coverage on this story, including an interview that we're making with William Ruckelshaus, the Deputy Attorney General, who was fired tonight, after this message. Special NBC report of another event this year that we never believed would have happened in the history of this republic. The president has accepted the resignation of the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson. He has fired the Deputy Attorney General, William Ruckelshaus. He has fired, through the new acting attorney general, the special Watergate prosecutor, Archibald Cox, and Mr. Nixon has directed that agents of the FBI seal off the offices of the special prosecutor, the the former Attorney General and the former Deputy Attorney General, and we've never heard anything like that before. All of this was precipitated, we believe, by the fact that the special Watergate prosecutor, Mr. Cox, utterly rejected the terms of a compromise on the secret White House tapes offered by the president on Friday night. Today, Saturday, Mr. Cox held a press conference in which he talked about that, and we're going to show you that. Later, we'll have an interview with William Druckelshaus and with Senator Baker of the Watergate Committee. But now, here is Cox's press conference of today.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to have had to bring you in on such a lovely day. There were three reasons for asking you to come in today. One, I wanted to give you the background of the events of last night, including some of the relevant papers that led up to them. Second, it seemed to me that having taken a stand that attracted some attention, that I owed it to you and to the public to try and answer as many of your questions as I properly can. There are still some limitations on what a prosecutor can say in public. And third, I was thought I wanted to say just a word or two about my personal attitude in this matter. I sort of hoped you would understand it, and it may be too personal, but I'll try. I read in one of the newspapers this morning the headline, Cox Defiant. I do want to say that I don't feel defiant. In fact, I told my wife this morning I hate a fight. Some things I feel very deeply about are at stake, and I hope that I can explain and defend them steadfastly. I'm not looking for a confrontation. I've worried a good deal through my life about the problems of imposing too much strain upon our constitutional institutions, and I'm certainly not out to get the President of the United States. I'm even worried, to put it in colloquial terms, that I'm getting too big for my britches, that what I see as principle could be vanity. I hope not. In the end, I decided that I had to try to stick by what I thought was right. Let me try to tell you what seems to me to be the essence of the current problem. And I'm sorry that this was put together so hastily that it'll be a little long. As you all know, there has been and is evidence, not proof perhaps in some instances, but clearly prima facie evidence of serious wrongdoing on the part of high government officials, wrongdoing involving an effort to cover up other wrongdoing. It appeared that papers, documents, and recordings of conversations in the White House, including the tapes, would be relevant to getting the truth about those incidents. I'm referring not only to the Watergate incident itself, but to other things involving electronic surveillance, break-ins at a doctor's office, and the like. Two courts have ruled that, with some exclusions, not only the tapes of nine conversations, but some very important papers, memoranda, and other documents bearing on those conversations, are relevant and should be supplied to pursue the investigation. Last night we were told that the court order would not be obeyed, that the papers, memoranda, and documents of that kind would not be provided at all, and that instead of the tapes, a summary of what they show would be provided. I think it is my duty as the special prosecutor, as an officer of the court, and as the representative of the grand jury, to bring to the court's attention what seems to me to be non-compliance with the court's order. If the court should rule that there was satisfactory compliance, then it would be my duty in those same capacities to abide by the court's order. And of course I would, and we would go about our business as best we can. That's what I regard as the basic adherence to our institutions of justice, which should be applied and followed in dealing with these problems. You will say, well, so far as the tapes are concerned, forget legalism. Isn't this a pretty good practical arrangement? I find four, to my way of thinking, insuperable difficulties with it. First, when criminal wrongdoing is the subject of investigation, and when one of those subjects is obstruction of justice in the form of a cover-up, then it seems to me it is simply not enough to make a compromise in which the real evidence is available only to two or three men operating in secrecy, all but one of them, the aides to the president, and men who have been associated with those who are the subject of the investigation. It's not a question of Senator Stennis's integrity. I have no doubt at all of Senator Stennis's personal integrity. But it seems to me that it's the kind of question where it is terribly important to adhere to the established institutions and not to accommodate it by some private arrangement involving, as I say, submitting the evidence ultimately to any one man. My second difficulty is that I will not know, and no one else will know, what standards have been applied in deciding what to exclude from the summary. For example, when I give you the various written proposals and comments that were exchanged, you will find that it is contemplated that there will be omitted references to matters related to the national defense or foreign policy whose disclosure would do real harm. I am very troubled by the lack of precision in those standards. We all know from matters that have been published that the Ellsberg Fielding break-in was described as matters affecting the national defense, and that the tapping of William Sapphire's and John Sears' telephones was apparently treated as a national security matter. Those certainly raise very serious questions as to whether criminal wrongdoing was not involved, although I must emphasize that I do not prejudge it. I just say they raise serious questions. My third reason for thinking that as a practical matter, I, as a charged with prosecuting violations, could not regard the arrangement is satisfactory, is that it's most unlikely, I don't go beyond that, most unlikely that a summary of the tapes would be admissible in evidence. It would be satisfactory for the purposes of a grand jury, I think, but I'm thinking of the actual conduct of the trial. If that was all that was available, and I was given to understand that the tapes would never be available under any circumstances, then I would be left without the evidence with which to prosecute people whom I had used the summaries perhaps to indict. Similarly, you have all read of cases in which those who have been charged with wrongdoing have said that they need the tapes in order to make their defenses. It seems to me most unlikely that a summary would be accepted by the defendants or that a court would regard it as sufficient. And that could very well mean that those prosecutions would have to be dropped. In my statement last night, pointed out that we were on the verge of such a problem in the prosecution of John Mitchell and Maurice Stans in the Vesco case in New York. Since then, there has been some suggestion, I understand by hearsay from the White House, that maybe those tapes would be made available or a transcript of them. I can't think that the two are unrelated. The other main part of the president's statement last night said that I would be instructed not to use the judicial process in order to obtain tapes, documents, memoranda relating to other presidential conversations. This instructs me not to pursue what would be the normal course of a prosecutor's duty in conducting this kind of investigation. And I think the instructions are inconsistent with pledges that were made to the United States Senate and through the Senate to the American people before I was appointed and before Attorney General Richardson's nomination was confirmed. If you go through the hearings, you will find repeated pledges by both of us that I should have complete independence to decide how to conduct these investigations and prosecutions, and particularly complete independence in determining what evidence to seek. There were also specific references to executive privilege and pledges by me and by the Attorney General that I not only would, in his view, be free to contest, but on my promise to the Senate that I would contest claims of executive privilege where I thought the evidence was material. This was finally summarized in the so-called guidelines and the departmental order put out by the Attorney General. It reads, the Attorney General will not countermand or interfere with the special prosecutor's decisions or actions. The special prosecutor will determine whether and to what extent he will inform or consult with the Attorney General about the conduct of his duties and responsibilities. The special prosecutor will not be removed from his duties for extraordinary improprieties on his part. I do want to emphasize that the giving of instructions in this very important respect isn't important because it interferes with Archie Cox. It's sort of embarrassing to be put in a position to say, well, I don't want the President of the United States to tell me what to do. I was brought up with the greatest respect for every President of the United States. But that isn't what's involved. It's that there's a basic change in the institutional arrangement that was established. There was a widespread feeling that there was need for an investigation conducted by someone wholly outside the administration who believed in the normal processes of the grand jury and the court, who would follow them and adhere to them, and who wouldn't be subject to instructions that might call him off or impede his work. And the purpose of this was to make it plain that the country would get such an investigation. It happened to be me. It may have been a good choice or a bad choice. But this changes it. And I don't think I could properly go on without making it plain that there had been a change. And indeed, I would have no interest in going on if there really was to be a radical change. But it wouldn't be right to continue with the pretense that we had the old arrangement while it was changed and instructions bearing on enormously important aspects of the duty had been given. And if they can be given once, then of course they can be given in the future. And I'm afraid if I acquiesced in them once, in the hopes of avoiding a confrontation, and as I say, I don't like confrontations, then I would find myself saying, well, it isn't worth doing it this time either. So it seemed to me that I ought to make plain what was happening. Now I turn to a bit of background. When the Court of Appeals first handed down its memorandum, now let me go a little bit back of that. The incidents of last night need to be viewed against two things. One is the whole problem of obtaining information for this investigation. And the other is the immediate discussions that took place between me and various representatives of the president. It's my characterization, but all I can say is that my efforts to get information, beginning in May, have been the subject of repeated frustration. This is a very special investigation in some way. The problem is unique because nearly all the evidence bearing not only on the Watergate incident and the alleged cover-up, but on the activities of the plumbers and other things of that kind, is in the White House papers and files. And unless you have access to those, you're not able to get the normal kind of information that a prosecutor must see. And written documentary evidence is far more reliable in a situation of this kind than the recollection of any witness, and certainly of interested witnesses. As I say, it seems to me that the record has been pretty much one of frustration, either through delays or refusals to provide things we ask. I haven't made a great point of it. While the legal question was being tested, it seemed to me that it would be right for the President's Counsel to say, well, let's get the law settled on these points, and then we can go on from there. And that it would be unfair of me, while the litigation was pending, to attempt to put public pressure on counsel to the president in these respects. But now, at least as of the moment, there's a question whether we can test the legal question. Let me give you an example. You'll recall that the papers of many White House aides